So the topic for today's Dharma talk is what I call love of practice. And sometimes we come to practice kicking and screaming. Sometimes we stumble upon it, something by seems like by chance. And sometimes we're just strongly or mysteriously drawn to the Dharma. For some of us, the practice is difficult, painful, challenging. And for some of us, it's extremely fun. Well, maybe it's sometimes it's painful and sometimes it's fun. The Buddha described four modes of progress. He described a mode of progress that is slow and painful, a mode of progress that is slow but pleasant, a mode of progress that is quick but painful, and a mode of progress that is both quick and pleasant. And what I find most interesting about these modes of progress is that all of them lead to awakening. Some of us have been deeply touched, I know, by practice, by the Dhamma, and we are aware of this gift of Dhamma and feel tremendous gratitude that in our lives we have encountered this precious teaching. So it doesn't matter to us so much whether the particular retreat or the particular practice we're undertaking or the particular phase we're at in our experience is painful or difficult, or if it's pleasant or easy. We have a sense of a love and a commitment to the Dharma that goes far beyond the feeling tone or the preferences of the pleasant. The Buddha was renowned for his renunciation, and even after his awakening, he continued to live in the forest. And when asked why he continued to live as a renunciate, he said it was both out of his own happiness, he enjoyed it, and for the benefit and compassion for future generations. He was already a well-known teacher. He could have lived anywhere, but he loved the life that he lived. When our practice gets a bit tedious, monotonous, painful, or difficult, I like to remember the discipline of the Buddha, that he maintained his discipline long after he had attained the goal. We don't need to hurry or rush to try to get through our meditation to kind of get it over with so that we can go on with our day. And we don't need to indulge thoughts like, maybe I've meditated enough for now, and just coast along for a few months without practice. When we can instead sense the potential of this Dharma, that it may be greater than we ever imagined, and trust in the Buddha's great example, that even after his awakening, he continued to live a simple life and he continued to meditate. We can consider how practice is embedded in the way that we relate to our lives, so that our Dharma practice goes beyond the time that we sit with our eyes closed. We can consider, how does the Dharma express itself while we're cooking dinner? How are we practicing when we are driving our cars? How can we bring practice into our relationships, into our conversations? Every moment of perception, there's a possibility that we can be aware, awake, mindful. We can meet the moment with wisdom and compassion. Our perceptions and our thoughts are likened to winds, and the mind training is likened to being a skilled sailor who adjusts the sails to capture the wind. We adjust and refine our relationship to what we're perceiving, to what we're experiencing. The sailor doesn't try to stop the winds. We don't need to stop experience. We adjust our relationship to it, how we're meeting it. So to speak, we're adjusting our sails on the seas of life so that we shift and make those nuanced, subtle adjustments to the way that we encounter ordinary experiences every day of our lives so that those ordinary experiences nourish our spiritual progress. Many of you know that I spent a number of years living in India, and I stayed for quite some time with a teacher named Poonjaji. And Poonja said, meditation is always beneficial, even after enlightenment. What else can you do? Meditation means that you don't have to be attached to anything that is not everlasting. Sit quiet and meditate always as much as you can. And Poonjaji was known for, he has a reputation in the West as being somebody who discouraged meditation. But I lived with him. I stayed in his house for years. So I know that he meditated. Well, I don't know that he did a meditation technique, but what I can say is that he sat with his legs crossed, his eyes closed, and his hands resting on each knee for many hours every day. And he appeared to be quite calm, alert, mindful. Every morning he would wake up, 4:30 or so in the morning, and he would sit. And then he would bathe, and then he would sit. And then he'd take a walk, and then he would sit. And then we would have breakfast, and then he would sit. We'd sit again when people came to speak to him in satsang, and he'd sit again after lunch, and then again in the afternoon, and again after dinner, and again before bed. It accumulated to many hours every day that this man, who is thought to not teach meditation and to discourage meditative effort, actually sat. I calculated it to be average about 6 to 8 hours a day until maybe the last year or so of his life, when he was very fatigued and would nap more. And maybe then he sat only 3 or 4 hours a day in the last year or so of his life. So to me, this is the way that we can really meditate, not just in the sitting posture, because he also encouraged us to have the same quality of meditative awareness in every activity. He loved the silence, but he also loved joy and laughter. He did whatever needed to be done, but whenever there was a pause between activities, whenever something wasn't needed from him, he would sit quietly and just experience that silent, that sense of being silently absorbed in the basic nature of life. What do you do when you meditate? Is it a big chore? Can you find times and ways to live a meditative life? Is meditation something that you feel like you should do, that it's kind of an obligation or a duty, or that you do it out of a kind of desperate personal need? Or is meditation, is it kind of a gruesome chore, or is it something that you love doing? Do you have to force yourself to sit? Or is meditation something that your mind just naturally inclines toward? Sometimes people fixate on the difficult. They fixate on the obstacles and the hindrances. And then meditation can feel like a lot of work. No doubt we have to address the hindrances, so we can't deny them. But we can also look beyond the hindrances, not be obsessed with them, so that we don't limit our meditation to tackling the hindrances and thereby miss those simple moments of calmness and joy that occur between the various activities of our days. Many of you have attended retreats, and you probably remember the closing circle when people share their experience and feel the deep gratitude and joy from having practiced together, even if it was a dukkha retreat, a retreat of great difficulty and suffering. It can still be a profound learning experience, and we can value it with great humor. For many people, meditation practice isn't a chore. It's something we look forward to. It's a kind of delight. And we can allow ourselves to find joy in our practice, to love mindfulness, and to be touched by the possibility of freedom that this path proposes. There's a real possibility that each one of us can live without discontent, without agitation, and live a peaceful, liberated life. Ajahn Buddhadasa wrote in Heartwood, or actually he said it and it was written in Heartwood, we don't have to do anything very much to make ourselves happy. We don't have to go to any great trouble. All we have to do is to empty our minds of greed, aversion, and delusion. Or in other words, to make it empty of grasping at and clinging to I and mine. When the mind is empty of greed, aversion, and delusion, then it is truly empty. And all dukkha comes to an end. Even karma of itself will come to an end. I like to encourage us to enjoy our meditation, to enjoy the pleasant moments. Sure, that's easy, but to also enjoy the unpleasant moments, to be receptive to the profound possibility of transformation so that we delight in the Dhamma, experiencing the happiness of the Dhamma that is not dependent upon sensual pleasures. When we love the practice, when we love freedom, it doesn't matter if it's pleasant or painful. It doesn't matter if our progress seems quick or slow. We might find that we just love meditating. We love our breath. We love our meditation object. We love where we are and this opportunity to be fully present with what is. This sincere devotion to the Dharma, to the path of liberation, can overcome all other desires. It's more powerful than the desire for sensual pleasures. The desire for freedom can be like a burning desire that has the potential to burn away all other attachments. Once we then taste the flavor, the taste of liberation and peace, we won't crave or cling to the temporary experiences of the senses. It's said that the love of freedom does the work. An Indian mystic, Kabir, said, "It is the intensity of the longing that does all the work." As we know in relationships, love requires sometimes some sacrifices. But in the context of love, the sacrifice is done happily, joyfully. It doesn't feel imposing. It feels like a gift. We tend to give ourselves to what we love. Rumi said, "Let yourself be silently drawn to the pull of what you really love." In the Samyutta Nikaya, it says, in the Mara Samyutta, "Now on that occasion, the Blessed One was instructing, exhorting, inspiring, and gladdening the bhikkhus with the talk, with the Dhamma talk concerning," in this discourse, it was the six bases for sense contact. But actually, there were a number of very similar discourses that addressed different teachings. So the Buddha was teaching on this subject. And then those bhikkhus were listening to the Dhamma with eager ears, attending to it as a matter of vital concern, applying their whole minds to it. That quality of wholehearted attention requires some degree of devotion, some degree of care and love of it. Interestingly, in the early discourses, we also find a teaching that says that there are two causes for the arising of right view, the voice of another, and wise attention. So it becomes very important even to develop this first factor of the Eightfold Path, right view, to practice the way that we listen to the Dhamma. How do you listen? How do you attend to Dhamma teachings? Can you make the act of listening a mindfulness practice to receive the teachings with openness, with wisdom? To delight in listening to the Dhamma is considered a blessing because not everybody recognizes the bliss of hearing the Dhamma. Probably tonight, I would speculate that more people are probably watching some action drama on TV than listening to a Dhamma talk right now. This opportunity, though, to meet the Dhamma, to practice the Dhamma, is very precious. In fact, it's one of the qualities and the characteristics that's said to make the human life a precious human life. It's precious because we have the possibility of hearing the Dhamma, of practicing the Dhamma, of being born into a time and a place when the liberating teachings are available. It may not be easy to sit every day. It may not be easy to carve out times for retreat. Sometimes we have to work pretty hard to protect our time, to gather our resources, to make it possible for us to deepen our practice in retreats and to maintain the continuity of our sitting practice. So whenever we find ourselves actually sitting down or just taking a moment to encounter the silence, we can cherish that opportunity and enjoy it fully. And so it doesn't matter if we sit down and we have an itch or the weather isn't quite what we want, or we go to a retreat and we don't really like the food that they're cooking. Those kinds of worldly conditions don't matter so much in comparison to the value of the Dhamma. And obviously, we certainly, when we go to a retreat, don't have the same expectations as we would at a resort hotel on a fancy vacation. But most retreats provide rather exceptional conditions for developing understanding and practicing letting go. And then when we sit in the comfort of our own homes or with the beauty of a community like this on Zoom, we're relatively comfortable, probably. You can at least pick of your various chairs in your house which one you're going to sit on. But nevertheless, as comfortable as we are, we can't predict what will occur in the next moment. What will occur in the environment? What will occur in the body? What will occur in our minds and emotions? In fact, if you sit down with a plan, chances are something else is going to happen. And if you've ever gone to a retreat with a plan, the wisest thing you can do is drop it. Expectations only lead to comparisons that create disappointments. Sometimes we struggle, and sometimes we experience waves of indescribable bliss. But whether that's bliss or struggle, it doesn't matter. Both give us the opportunity to grow and to be present and to incline towards freedom and release. Very few people tell me they're going on a retreat for fun. Most people say they're going to deepen their practice. They're going for a spiritual development. They say that it's a rich and valuable experience. But is it fun? Have you ever had fun on retreat? I hope you have. Because I actually find it fun, even if what I'm observing is painful. It's quite a delight to actually see the mind doing the things that cause suffering. Because often when things are painful, it's because there's some delusion. It's because there's some attachment, some clinging, some grasping. And it can be quite delightful to actually see the mind doing things that it knows better than to do. And when we see it, we can laugh at the foolishness of our own minds, and we can embrace our own habits and recognize how deep those patterns run. So we don't need to beat ourselves up for it. We can actually be relieved that we're seeing it and know that this practice, it may not be fun like a trivial game, but there's a quality of joy and delight and upliftment in it that I encourage you to enjoy. Even if it's a kind of a heavy moment and we touch into something that just is really, this is a heavy experience, there can still be a relief that we are actually seeing the suffering and the cause of suffering. Because when we are seeing it with mindfulness and when we are meeting it, though we are experiencing it and it is unpleasant, we are not trapped by it. When we undertake deep practice, we're not doing so to try and accumulate esoteric experiences. There isn't the greed for more kind of selfish time just to be by myself with me, or greed for spiritual knowledge. But we undertake a deep practice with a profound appreciation for the wondrous opportunity that we have simply because we're alive and we're to some degree aware. And that brings out our compassion for ourselves and others and our deep love of the potential that this path offers. There really is a possibility of ending the causes of suffering. There's a bodhisattva motivation where we practice for the benefit of all beings. And I find this bodhisattva motivation to be very interesting. I don't personally interpret it to require the waiting for awakening, holding off a personal awakening, or holding off our the complete letting go of the defilements until all other beings have done so. But I see this bodhisattva motivation as recognizing that our practice is for the benefit of all. That the experience of liberation is the ending of greed, hate, and delusion. And how can that be anything other than for the benefit of all? It's not for personal attainment. It's not for a personal ego glory. It's not just for our own kind of ease and well-being, but it really brings peace and profound love to all life, and that benefits everyone. The love that we experience of the Dhamma is not limited to just the time we're sitting on the cushion or in retreat, but it permeates the encounter with every moment of our lives. Poonjaji said, "Meditation has no time. Don't look at the watch when you sit. If you do, you are not meditating, but you are concentrating on time only. All your life, waking, dreaming, sleeping, just meditate." So we practice meditation. We practice to realize the end of the causes of suffering. We can appreciate the opportunities that we have, whatever they may be, every moment of our lives. There's so many times throughout a day that we might find our minds drifting off. That's an opportunity to restore mindfulness. We don't have to rush to the zafu and sit with our legs crossed, just right in the midst of frying an egg or putting a stamp on a letter, whatever we might be doing. When the mind wanders off, we bring ourselves right into a clear and wise encounter with whatever is actually happening. But though we may integrate our practice throughout the day, I do think it's important to sit. And there's a story of when Milarepa was leaving his teacher Marpa, the graduation advice that Marpa gave him was to basically, as he was departing, he bent over and mooned him. He pulled up his robes and he mooned him. And it wasn't intended as an offensive gesture. He was showing him the calluses on his buttocks. Can we practice with such diligence to be willing to sit through hardships because we're committed to understand suffering, the causes of suffering, and the end of suffering, even if it's not pleasant? We each have to do the work. We have to walk the path of Dharma for ourselves. And it may take steadfast commitment to dedicate ourselves to what we love. If we love clinging more than liberation, then we're going to foster attachments. If we're enchanted with shopping, personal prestige, wealth, power, approval, or whatnot, that's what we're going to pursue. A few decades ago, I was up at Spirit Rock, and there was a Zen teacher that was giving an evening talk, Harada Roshi. And at the end of his talk, there was a question and answer session. And somebody in the audience stood up and said, I've been practicing TM and Vipassana, and I was wondering if it mattered which I pursued. And already that's an odd question, because she's asking a Zen practitioner. And that wasn't one of the options. But nevertheless, his response was really interesting to me. He said, as long as you put your life on the line, it does not matter which practice you choose. Each of us may at times pursue different approaches to meditation. We might encounter different styles and want to explore them. We might meet different teachers and want to explore their approaches and the methods that they recommend. Sometimes we might emphasize samadhi, sometimes loving kindness, sometimes the experience of emptiness, sometimes the contemplation of impermanence. It's all fine. This doesn't necessarily mean that we're superficially shopping, you know, spiritual shopping out there in a superficial way. But do you realize that your life is on the line? It's actually on the line all the time, because every day, whatever we did that day, we traded a day of our life for it. We don't get that time back. Did we live today fully? Were we aware? Was the Dharma a theme that we touched into and remembered at different points in the day, throughout the day? Or were we just spaced out, lost in our personal stories, our personal dramas? Sometimes people say they love their life, but are not so present for it. I say, yes, love your life and love your practice. And love being fully present for it. We all know that we will die, that we don't get to avoid that. And when we contemplate death, very often this leads us to strengthen the wish to live more fully. This wish to live more fully, this luck can be expressed in our love of awareness, our love of peace, of wisdom, our appreciation for silence. And it can manifest in the commitment to come on a Sunday night to this event, to maintain our connection with community members, with Sangha members, even over Zoom. The commitment to sit each day, to engage in service, to do the little tasks that it takes to keep Dharma programs going. When we come to an event, to listen fully, to really listen, to listen to the Dharma, to listen to each other, to nurture also the values for silence in our lives, to experience silence in the context of daily activities and in nature, to care for our communities, and to do the activities that bring great joy, like the joy that's expressed and the appreciation that's expressed through acts of generosity and dana. There are many different styles of loving. Some people love very subtly, very quietly, shyly even. Their love can still permeate each moment such that every act is an act of worship. Others love more passionately, like a fire that burns in their hearts. They're consumed almost by this devotion for freedom, this love of truth. Whether your approach is naturally on the subtle side or the more fiery, passionate side, listen to the values that influence your daily choices so that we don't waste our lives on trivial things when the Dhamma is calling to us. One of my Tibetan teachers, Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche, used to say, "The Dharma is like the sun. It shines on everyone." It's not just for monastics. It's not just for Asians. It's available to all beings who endeavor to practice it. This is a cause for great joy. There are many times in our practice when I think we can let ourselves be a bit wowed. You know, just wow. My mind was just struggling with that defilement. Oh, anger or lust or aversion or envy or whatever it might be. And it let go. Wow. That's amazing. We can observe our own experience. We can watch our attention drop into the body to really be present here and now without dwelling in thoughts of the past or planning for the future. That's wow. Every time we become mindful, it's amazing. It's marvelous. We can drop into that recognition of being mindful and almost say, wow, this is amazing. Look, there's a tingle. There's warmth. Whatever it might be, not keep the big wow, the wows for big, like unusual experiences. Let's experience wow, amazing, with being mindful of the ordinary ones, to really appreciate our capacity to simply be aware and to love the ease that comes with mindfulness, the freedom that comes with this encounter with reality, to love that more than we love our sandwiches, our houses, our personal dramas, our individual quirks, our vehicles, our gardens. We don't need to remain fascinated with the hindrances and the obstructions and the personal patterns that we have developed over our lives. All those things arise and they pass away. But we can open with a kind of natural, wakeful mindfulness to know the nature of experience just as it is. And when we meet the moment just as it is, we are meeting a slice of the nature of all things. I want to end with a verse that we find repeated in the discourses of the Buddha, that often ended discourses, was at the end of discourses, where the Buddha said, "There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you." What I'd like to have is just a couple of minutes, like 2 minutes, just to let some of that settle. And then we'll have a few minutes for questions, and then we'll do some of the metta cards. So let's just have a moment or two of silence, and then I'll ring the bell. And if you have a question, you can formulate it. So did anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, then how about if Jan, would you share metta with us?
Wait, I want to say something.
Oh, okay. Who's speaking?
This is Sarah.
Oh, hi, Sarah. Nice
to see you. I want to say I will listen to this talk again and again. Thank you very much. No question, just thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Deborah?
Ditto.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. It was really, I always love your talks, but this was just really mesmerizing. I said that word about a Dharma talk last week. Maybe it's me, but maybe it's just the wonderful teachers we get to have at Marin Sangha. So thank you, Shayla. That was beautiful.
Lovely, lovely. I think it's great to be mesmerized in a way that to me says you're really present, listening to the different voices, the different expressions of the Dhamma. Okay. Let's see. Is it Sherry?
Yes, it was Bowman. I just wanted to say that, wow, that was amazing. I mean, it was really... you know, it just reminded, your talk reminds me to be present in the moment every day, all day long. And, and to see the amazement in the moment. It was a great talk. Thank you very much, Shayla. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.